So I'm a pretty big Marvel fan, and there was a scene in Captain America: The First Avenger that really stood out to me. The one where a scrawny Steve Rogers, before he's transformed into a buff Captain America, jumps on a dummy grenade during a training exercise to protect his fellow soldiers. He, of course, thought the grenade was real, but was willing to sacrifice himself for his team. I remember watching that scene and thinking, yeah, that's Captain America material right there. Well, now I come to find out there was a native-born Detroiter who did that in real life, in the midst of combat, with a live explosive. During the Korean War, Robert E. Simonek threw himself on an enemy grenade, shielding his fellow Marines from harm. And last month, his daughter traveled to California to honor him.
For the United States of America, I christen thee USMS Robert E. Simonek. May God bless this ship and all who sail in her.
That naval ship is named after her father, who received the Congressional Medal of Honor in 1953. That's this week on the Up North Lowdown from Interlochen Public Radio. We'll hear about that, plus a conversation with author Curtis Chin. His memoir tells the story of growing up in his family's Chinese restaurant in Detroit, and he was recently in Traverse City to talk about it. But first, trouble for newspapers in northern Michigan. The editor who oversaw many northern Michigan newspapers, including the Petoskey News Review and the Sheboygan Daily Tribune, is out of a job. Sarah Leach was fired by executives at parent company Gannett last month after she was accused of sharing proprietary information with the Poynter Institute, a nonprofit that covers the journalism industry. Earlier this year, Gannett paused an initiative to hire more than 24 reporters in understaffed newsrooms across the country. Leach, an editor with more than 25 years of experience, spoke with Poynter about the challenges that presented. So what does the editor's firing mean for local news in Petoskey, Sheboygan, and other parts of northern Michigan? Well, she talked about that with IPR's Michael Livingston.
Sarah, before we start, just a note, journalism is a small world. You and I have worked together before, mainly when I was a student reporter at Central Michigan University. The first thing I want to ask you is, did you know when you spoke to Poynter that your job would be on the line?
I knew in the back of my mind that they probably would be happy if they knew I was having that conversation, but I didn't think that my job was in jeopardy, no.
And Gannett has made plenty of headlines in the past for shrinking staff all over the country. Can you give us an idea of how many reporters typically work at a Gannett newsroom in northern Michigan, which you oversaw?
Well, those are the small community papers, which I oversaw all of those in northern Michigan, and none of them have more than one news reporter, and at least one has none.
Wow. I have to ask, you know, how were you able to cover communities with those kinds of resources?
Well, we had to get creative in a lot of ways. So what we first did was we tried to, rather than manage those newspapers independently of one another, we tried to collaborate together and tried to pair resources together. So where we did have reporters, maybe you could do a regional story that would apply to the places where we didn't have a reporter, and at least some of the news would be relevant to those readerships. And that worked a little bit. And then we also relied a lot on news from the Detroit Free Press, which is the flagship paper in Michigan.
And Gannett had this initiative to bring on, I think it was 30 additional reporters at papers across the country. What kind of difference would that have made to our region?
Well, I think that the intentions were altruistic when we first heard about the initiative, and it's something that we were excited about. We want our communities to know that we're showing up. And we were hearing from a lot of places where we didn't have reporters for significant periods of time. For example, the Sheboygan Daily Tribune. That paper hasn't had a news reporter since 2022. And we know how damaging that can be to a community where they feel like they're not really being served. And we wanted to get those bodies into those newsrooms so that we could show up and you know, provide local news content for these communities. But then ultimately, I'm not exactly clear as to why that never materialized, but ultimately that was scrapped or at least put on significant hold in this year.
The term that gets thrown around for northern Michigan sometimes is news desert.
Mm-hmm. I refer to them as ghost newsrooms sometimes because that's what they are. And we don't really talk about it in media companies. That it's a point of embarrassment, I think, for a lot of companies because they don't really have a clear answer as to how to solve that problem. I tried while I was within the company to encourage leadership to have that conversation and to lead that conversation so that we could brainstorm and explore solutions so that it could ultimately be a positive conversation that the company could lead.
I want to ask too, why should someone who doesn't have our job care about this, about newspapers that are fully staffed?
Yeah, this is the hardest thing to explain to people who aren't in the business because you don't know what you don't know. And oftentimes people don't care about having access to information until something happens, usually something negative that impacts them personally. That could be as simple as your tax bill going up and you didn't know that you were going to be taxed more, all the way up to the more extreme examples of government corruption and the like. I think that because we live in an age where people have easy access to information in lots of different ways, people sort of believe that if they're savvy enough that they can find the information that they need and that they don't need to read the traditionally provided news in these traditional sources. And I would say that that is a slippery slope because, again, it's going to put you at a huge disadvantage in terms of accessing information, and you're going to be behind the curve once something actually happens, and you're not going to understand why unless you have somebody who's trained to do this and can get in there, ask the right questions so that you have the right answers.
What are you hoping for the future of these communities that you once served, places like Petoskey, Sheboygan, Gaylord? Do you see Gannett stepping up and staffing these newsrooms, or will it come from a different source?
It will depend on how they respond to this. I realize that this isn't the most ideal situation either for me or for them. I'm hoping that they are willing to maybe, at least to put a good foot forward to the public, will consider revisiting not staffing these papers for the past few years, and hopefully they'll be able to get creative in finding the resources to do this. If not, I think that communities, I'm really encouraging people to try to get a seat at that table and demand more from the media that they're getting. You have a right to and a say in what your local community newspaper looks like. It's not just about subscribing or canceling your subscription. You also have a right to have an opinion, and you should be fighting to get credible information with as few barriers as possible.
It kind of seems Gannett was hoping not to draw attention to this matter. It strikes me that now that they fired you, you're free to speak your mind on this topic.
It is the ultimate irony, isn't it?
So to speak, yeah. I'm wondering too, you know, your work speaks volumes, especially the coverage of a very volatile situation in Ottawa County. Have you heard from any of your sources and colleagues about what happened to you?
Yeah, I've had some conversations privately with the people that I worked with. I want to be clear that I support all of the people that I was managing and that I worked with prior to leaving. I believe in them. They are skilled people. They don't deserve any negative attention that might be a repercussion of the situation. I fully support them, and I will be subscribing to those papers because of them. I think that also, I have had sources come forward and express deep concerns about what this means for the Sentinel and how this issue is going to be covered. I have tried to broker some arrangements with some local affiliates so that I can continue my commitment to seeing this through to the end of the 24 election cycle, which is a promise that I made to the community 18 months ago. It is something that I think is of critical need, and frankly, that is of a higher importance than my career with Gannett.
That's Sarah Leach, a former editor who oversaw 26 Gannett newspapers in 4 different states, including several papers here in Michigan. She spoke with IPR's Michael Livingston. We reached out to Gannett, and a spokesperson said the company will not comment on personnel issues, but that it, quote, remains committed to adding resources to support our newsrooms, including those in Michigan. As for Sarah, she promised to continue her coverage of the Ottawa County Health Department on her Substack. You can link to it at iprnews.org. On August 17th, 1952, Robert E. Simonac was a private first class in the Marines fighting in Korea when his unit was ambushed. He threw himself on a grenade, absorbing the explosion with his body and saving the lives of those around him. But the explosion did not kill him, although it did damage his legs. A year later, in 1953, he received the Congressional Medal of Honor from President Eisenhower. His daughter, Sam Clark, lives in Traverse City, and last month she traveled to California to dedicate a U.S. Navy ship bearing her father's name.
Dad was a very kind of quiet guy. He was the third of four brothers, grew up in Detroit proper, and not a very wealthy upbringing, so they really fended for themselves. His three brothers also served, and served longer than my dad. He was actually only in Korea about 4 months before he jumped on a hand grenade and got blown up. His home life was pretty quiet. He worked, he came home from work, he brought me Slim Jim sandwiches from Big Boy. We'd curl up and watch MASH together, and he'd say, "Hey, I rode on one of those helicopters." When the Commandant of the Marine Corps called him in January of 2021 and told him that there would be a Navy vessel named for him, my dad at first didn't believe it at all. He thought somebody was playing a joke on him because he had a really good sense of humor, and he figured somebody was trying to get him back. And then he finally realized he was indeed talking to the Commandant of the Marine Corps, and he actually stood up in honor and respect for the Commandant. And the Commandant said, "No, no, I should be standing up." It is not unusual for a Navy ship to be named after a Marine. In fact, this whole series of this type of ship, the Expeditionary Sea Bases, have all been named for Marines who are Medal of Honor recipients.
For the United States of America, I christen thee USNS Robert E. Siminek. May God bless this ship and all who sail in her.
Yes, I did indeed smash the bottle of champagne on the ship. Just as soon as I smashed it, I just felt this joy. It was really surreal, and it kind of came home to me, and so I splashed it all over the side of the ship because it was already floating. I didn't get to actually smash it on the bow. And kissed my hand, kissed the ship, and wished her farewell and following seas.
And we christened the USS Robert E. Siminek, ESB-7.
The USNS Robert E. Siminek is a support ship more than anything. It's this huge, versatile thing that can just do about anything. It sweeps for mines. It serves as a respite for troops that are out there that might need a place to land their helicopters on. It's a support vehicle. So my hope, of course, above all, and my dad's hope, was that there be peace, and that the ship will serve as a peaceful support ship to help people of all nations, and that it is going to serve with compassion and inclusivity. He would be speechless. My dad, when he saw this ship, or, you know, when he observed the proceedings that happened, my dad would have just said, "Sheesh, sheesh," over and over and over again, and he wouldn't have known what to say. He wasn't very verbose, and he just he'd have been flabbergasted, overwhelmed, and grinning from ear to ear.
That was Traverse City resident Sam Clark talking about her father, Robert E. Siminek, and the Navy ship now bearing his name. Siminek died in August of 2022, just shy of the 70th anniversary of his act of heroism in Korea. That story was produced by IPR's Ed Ronco. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
I'm Ed Ronco. I have been the news director at IPR since the summer of 2022. We focus a lot of our coverage on the environment, from the lakes to the climate to agriculture and energy. And we pay attention to the issues we face here in northern Michigan, including housing and how being in a rural area defines us and helps us and gets in our way sometimes. We want IPR News to reflect northern Michigan. Tell us what you think at interlochenpublicradio.org/talk.
Welcome back to the Up North Lowdown. I'm Max Copeland. Back in 2015, the Canadian charity Aqua Action started the Great Lakes Aqua Hacking Competition. This year, 10 research teams from the United States and Canada competed in the challenge at Northwestern Michigan College in Traverse City. And a Traverse City startup won second place for a portable PFAS detection kit. Josh Francis is a co-owner of Wave Lumina.
What this device would do would allow someone to go into the field, get immediate results at one-third of the cost of current testing.
He says for now, it is a rough screening tool and will not be used for drinking water. The Philadelphia-based company Belina won first place with a microplastics filter that can be installed directly into household washing machines. Co-founder Sarah Beth Gleason says it's pretty straightforward.
So you can just load it like a normal washing machine load and then run the cycle, and then it'll filter using the natural motion of the machine.
Many modern clothes are made with synthetic fibers, which can leach into the water supply through unfiltered wastewater from washing machines. This was the first time the competition was held in the U.S., but organizers say they are planning to come back to Traverse City next year. May is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. And on Thursday, the Denos Museum Center in Traverse City hosted a conversation with author Curtis Chin. His memoir, Everything I Learned in a Chinese Restaurant, talks about growing up Chinese American in 1980s Detroit and helping out at his family's business. Chin spoke with IPR's Tyler Thompson about what the restaurant was like and how it shaped the person he is today.
Wow, the restaurant was called Chung's Cantonese Cuisine. It was actually opened by my great-grandfather in 1940. So by the time I got around, it had already been established as one of the best, if not the best, Chinese restaurant in Detroit. Everybody went there, from Mayor Coleman Young to literally the pimps and prostitutes on the street corner in the corridor. We saw it all. And, you know, a big part of my memoir is recounting all these fabulous customers that came through our door and all the different things I learned by interacting with them.
You know, I know you mentioned that in Detroit, it was a tough time in the 70s and the 80s, but it sounds like the restaurant was sort of like a, I don't know, like a haven, but it just seemed like welcoming to all folks.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. You know, even though during the summer months, you know, we'd be there as much as 80 hours a week, like 7 days a week, open to close, I felt like I still got to see the city because the whole city was coming into our dining room. I mean, you know, in Detroit, there was always that divide, not just of 8 Mile, but also of 6 p.m., where during the day, it would be all white-collar workers, professionals from the area, both from the New Center area, but also like the downtown core. But then afterwards, it would be the people who lived around the corridor. So we really, working there, really got to see everybody and interact with everybody and just really felt really integrated into the whole city.
And a lot of those experiences sort of shaped who you are today.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. I mean, people often ask me, what is the first lesson that you learned growing up in that Chinese restaurant? And I always say that when you're a little kid, your parents say, don't talk to strangers. My parents gave us the exact opposite, you know, advice. They said, talk to strangers. And who they were talking about were those people sitting in our dining room. Because my mom didn't have a chance to graduate high school. My dad went to community college for 2 semesters. So they didn't necessarily know all the opportunities that existed outside of the 4 walls of that restaurant. But they knew that they had this dining room full of people who did. And so anytime my dad met somebody who he thought, well, I don't know, had an interesting job or just, you know, just seemed really happy, he'd call all 6 of us kids to run over and barrage them with questions of, what do you do for a living? You know, how'd you get your job? How much money do you make? And, you know, it just opened up our eyes to all the opportunities that existed. So, yeah, I never felt like the restaurant constrained me, but the exact opposite. I felt like that restaurant opened so many doors for me.
Yeah. You know, you're a storyteller, you know, you wrote a book, you work on documentaries, and you have a lot to pull from there. What do you value about storytelling, and what do you try to achieve as a storyteller?
Well, storytelling is so important because it really gets us to connect with each other, right? I mean, I think this relates to social justice issues, because that's a very passionate issue of mine, is that if people don't see you as an individual, as a person, or even as an American, why would they think that you deserve equal rights, that you belong in this country? And so that's always been a big part of me telling my family story. I like to talk about the fact that my family arrived in Michigan in the late 1800s. It was a really different, you know, city back then. But to think that there were, you know, Asians in Detroit long before there was a Ford Motor Company or even Motown music, I think just blows people's minds, you know, thinking about like, oh, what was your family doing back then, you know, or yeah. How did they help contribute to the building of the city of Detroit? I'm very proud of that history, and that's why I like to talk about it.
What do you hope that people take away from your story? What are some of the things that you're going to hit on, and what do you hope people learn about your coming of age story?
I jokingly said that, you know, for people of color, it talks about racism. For gay people, it talks about, you know, the coming out process. For Jewish people, we talk about Chinese food. You know, we hit all three audiences, we're good. But it seems that the book has actually even expanded beyond that, because like I said, it's a very Detroit book. It's also a very 80s book. There's so much pop reference to that era, whether you're talking about the music or whether you're talking about TV shows. You know, I jokingly say that I was the Asian Alex P. Keaton growing up in high school. You know, I don't know if people remember that show Family Ties or not, but yeah, there's a lot going on in the book. And so what do I hope? Part of the reason I wrote the book is that we live in a very divided country right now. We have these little silos where we don't talk to each other, but Chinese restaurants are actually one of the few places where you can go in and see somebody from a different race, religion, you know, socioeconomic background. And you know, maybe if you just took the time to just lean over and ask the next person, hey, what are you eating? And you struck up a conversation. Maybe those are the baby steps that our country needs to take to sort of heal ourselves. Because, I mean, in a lot of ways, it doesn't seem like we can even make small talk with each other anymore, which is really quite sad to me, you know, as someone who grew up in a Chinese restaurant where, you know, we love making small talk. We love learning about, you know, different things from different people. We love being able to connect. That doesn't mean we always have to agree on everything, but we should at least be civil with each other. And so maybe that's in some ways what I'm hoping will come out of the book. You know, the way I also pitched it to my agent was come for the egg rolls, save for the talk on racism. Because, you know, these are very serious issues that we're dealing with in our country. And I think we have to have these conversations, but hopefully we're doing it in a way that actually brings us together and foster greater understanding rather than drives us apart.
Author Curtis Chin, speaking with IPR's Tyler Thompson. Chin's new memoir is titled Everything I Learned in a Chinese Restaurant. All right, let's find out what else made news in Michigan this week. A new state program will allow new mothers held in state prisons to send breast milk home to feed their newborns. Participating mothers will pump milk in prison facilities where it will be stored until it is picked up by a family member or caregiver. A spokesperson for the Michigan Department of Corrections says, while there are typically very few new mothers in prison, this initiative is important for the health and development of newborns and helps incarcerated mothers maintain connection with their families. The program will begin this summer. A new research collaboration aiming to help Michigan's agricultural producers thrive in the face of climate change has chosen its first four projects. It's a joint effort among Michigan State University, the state government, and plant agriculture groups. The initial projects include adapting fruit trees to changing weather patterns and addressing water and pest management issues. Attorney General Dana Nessel plans to sue oil and gas companies for damages caused by climate change. Michigan will join dozens of other local, tribal, and state governments taking similar steps. Nessel claims companies knew about the dangers of increasing carbon emissions for decades, but minimized those threats. In an emailed statement, a spokesperson for the American Petroleum Institute says climate policy should be handled in Congress, not in the courts. Cruise lines are looking to the Great Lakes for voyages ahead of what may be a record-breaking season. Cruises could surpass $200 million in regional economic impacts this year. According to the marketing group Cruise the Great Lakes, ships are expected to make close to 600 port visits to towns and cities, bringing more than 20,000 passengers with them. A tribal commercial fishery in Peshawe Town is joining the 100% Great Lakes Fish Pledge. Treaty Fish Company is the fifth Michigan business to participate. The initiative aims to increase the value of commercially caught species like whitefish beyond just the price of a fillet. It's modeled after an Icelandic program that successfully increased the value of Atlantic cod by using fish for products like medical bandages and cosmetics. Treaty Fish Company will now give waste products like carcasses to the Grand Traverse Bands of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians Agriculture Department to be used as fertilizer. Our other podcast, Points North, just did a story about this. You can hear more about the 100% Great Lakes Fish Pledge by listening to that episode of Points North called More Than a Fillet of Fish on pointsnorthpodcast.org or wherever you're listening to this podcast. That's it for the Up North Lowdown this week. We had contributions from Michael Livingston, Ellie Katz, Izzy Ross, and Tyler Thompson. Music is by Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Max Copeland. I also produced the Lowdown. We had editorial support from Ed Ronco and Dan Wanchura. The Up North Lowdown is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. This week, spring is in the air, and the chickadees are displaying a variety of songs. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.
It's about learning new things and trying something different all the time.
The amazingly versatile composer Jason Graves joins us this week to talk about his scores for blockbuster titles like Tomb Raider and Dead Space, and even a soundtrack he wrote for a video game store. I'm Keith Brown, inviting you to join me for the music of Jason Graves this week on Gameplay.
You can stream full episodes of Gameplay on demand and view playlists at gameplayshow.org.